Do you think somebody without that background has really got the tools to deal with the problems that the Director General faces?
I think it's possible, and there's some question that there's going to be a Deputy Director General post, as there was under Mark Thompson when Mark Byford was the Deputy Director of the DG of the BBC, just to look at news and associated editorial content. But I do think you're right that you need that sixth sense that when there is trouble coming over the horizon, and candidates with editorial backgrounds tend to be able to speak more to the fact that they just get an itch that something is coming. They can see problems before they arise and hit the public sphere, because it just helps you to do that kind of firefighting, you know, to control issues before they blow up into something really big. And I think that is a really important skill.
Well, that was Jamie Angus, the former director of the BBC World Service. And that is it from me today. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. Ryan Boyden was the technical operator. Up next is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover. They're in the studio. I can see them right in front of me. And they're going to take us through after I leave.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
And it is now 2 o'clock. Good afternoon. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio.
We've got a packed couple of hours for you. We're going to be on the ground in the all-important by-election constituency of Gorton and Denton. What are people thinking and feeling there right now? We're asking, why are so few women making it to the very top of Britain's biggest companies? And after 3:30, our big guest of the day is the best-selling crime writer Harriet Tice, who you might remember as the ultimate faithful on the latest series of The Traitors.
And all of that comes after the latest news headlines with Laura Cook.
Good afternoon. John Healey has told Times Radio he wants to be the defence secretary that puts UK boots on the ground in Ukraine. He says he wants to see the Russian war end this year, but accused President Putin of dragging his feet in peace talks. The defence secretary says if Moscow takes negotiations seriously, Britain's ready to secure peace for the long term.
Every conflict, every war has to end in negotiation. I want to see 2026, the year that this war does end. I want to be the defence secretary that deploys UK troops into Ukraine, because that will mean we've got a negotiated peace in place.
That was Defence Secretary John Healey. You can hear that interview on Times Radio Drive with John Pienaar from 4 this afternoon. Ministers have confirmed they'll support a Lib Dem effort in Parliament to ensure documents about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's appointment as a trade envoy are made public. The former prince had that job for a decade to 2011, with recent documents released in the US appearing to show he shared sensitive information with Jeffrey Epstein. Lib Dem leader Ed Davey referred to any association with Epstein as a stain on our country.
In many ways, this is the first truly global scandal, from the White House and Silicon Valley to Oslo and Paris. But it's also a deeply British scandal, reaching right to the top of the British establishment. Because can there be many people more symbolic of the rot that eats away at the British establishment than the former Duke of York and Special Trade Envoy, and the former Business Secretary, First Secretary of State, and Ambassador to the United States?
Both Andrew and Peter Mandelson have denied any wrongdoing. Reddit has been fined more than £14 million by the Information Commissioner's Office for failing to keep children safe. An investigation by the data protection watchdogs found the social media platform didn't check ages properly. It says some may have been exposed to inappropriate and harmful content. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch has been speaking at a panel of bereaved parents, urging the government to follow through with a ban on social media for under-16s.
Social media is for adults, it is not for children. We need to police the age. That is easier than policing the content. Children aren't always looking for this content. It's often pushed to them, and we need to make sure that we can keep our children safe.
Russell Brand has pleaded not guilty to one further count of rape and one of sexual assault, both alleged to have taken place in 2009. He'll go on trial in June after previously denying five other charges involving four women. A BAFTA judge has resigned and accused the organisation of being inherently unsafe for black and disabled people. It follows the controversy surrounding the awards ceremony on Sunday. Producer Jonte Richardson has quit his role on the emerging talent judging panel over the incident in which a Tourette's campaign involuntarily shouted a racial slur at the Sinners actors Delroy Lindo and Michael B. Jordan as they appeared on stage. Museums are using tactics from the Blitz to update their contingency plans for how they'd protect their artefacts in the event of war. It would involve items being moved to cellars or underground stations or being sandbagged or bricked up if they're too big. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Right, a trifle unnerving, that final story in the bulletin there, but we'll move on. Let's focus on the positive. Good afternoon. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover here until 4 o'clock on Times Radio. We're on the ground in Gorton and Denton in a couple of minutes' time. That make or break, they're saying, by-election for Sir Keir Starmer is on Thursday. But in fact, Labour could win it. It might go Green or it could go Reform UK. What are the people of the constituency feeling about it all? We're asking whether or not you should go ahead with a holiday in Mexico. Are there enough women at the top of British business? We'll talk about that. It's 4 years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, 4 years to the day. And we'll talk to the UNHCR in Kyiv this afternoon. And the doctor's in the house, as she is every Tuesday. It's Rachel Ward on the big health stories of the week, including GPs and the prescription of fat jabs, so-called, and celebrations around the birth of a lovely baby boy called Hugo, whose mother was given a transplanted womb. And sporting glory for Team GB, even at Milan Cortina. We have got a medalist with us this afternoon, Zoe Atkin, who won a bronze in the women's half pipe. And Vassos Alexander, who was with us yesterday, he's our sportsman, who is wrestling with whether or not he'd represent Team GB or Greece. Should he ever be, slightly unexpectedly, because he's of a certain age, I mean, he's not as old as me, but he's not in his 20s, is he? Should he ever be called up?
But he could turn his hand to a three-quarter pipe, a quarter pipe, a seven-eighth of a pipe. He's an incredibly fit man. He does all of those ultra-marathons and triathlons and stuff.
So it's not beyond the bounds.
It's not beyond it at all.
Okay,
no.
Right. Well,
he's closer to it than you and I are.
Yeah, well, that's without doubt. I wouldn't disagree with that. What are we doing? We're talking about the by-election in a moment. But first, the most read stories on the Times website.
Can I just tell you who's our guest after 3:30 afternoon? So that is Harriet Tice. So she has sold millions of copies of her novels. They're psychological thrillers. The fifth one is out now. It's called Witch Trial. Two girls accused of murder, a defence like no other. If you are an aficionado of Harriet Tice, you will have been thrilled to see her appear as a faithful on the latest series of The Traitors, where she really, really gave some welly to the faithful position, and she lost it at breakfast with Rachel one morning. If you don't watch Traitors, you're thinking, what is this woman rambling about? But if you did watch it, you'll know exactly who I mean. She's on after 3:30, plenty to talk about with her.
Yeah, Harriet Tice, novelist and star of The Traitors, with us this afternoon. And so, seamlessly, we move on to the most read stories on the Times website this afternoon.
Good to hear it again. In at number three, Britain's new ambassador to the US makes bright start in Mandelson's shadow. Katie Balls writes that Christian Turner has been welcomed to Washington, but she says he's got more work to do to turn conversations away from his predecessor and back towards the UK. The second most read story, Martin Lewis in debt to Kemi Badenoch after gate crashing her interview. Now, this is the Times sketch writer, the fantastic Tom Peck, who is talking about the money-saving expert who interrupted Kemi Badenoch to talk student loans live on ITV. Tom Peck brilliantly describes Martin Lewis as the human discount code. If you're going to read one thing this afternoon to make yourself smile, I would highly recommend that. And the most read piece on the Times website is exactly the same story. Martin Lewis is missing the point on student debt. Our head of money says that Kemi Badenoch's pledge to cut interest rates on student loans is actually the right call to make. You can read all of those articles on thetimes.com. You need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
Yeah, for once, news TV, and particularly breakfast television, which is alien to me, Fiona, because I'm listening to the wireless,
of course
everybody is first thing in the morning. But apparently some people put the TV on, never really got that. But I have seen that clip. Have you seen it? Where Martin just enters the fray and Kemi Badenoch's being interviewed and all of a sudden Martin Lewis is part of the conversational mix. It's a bit bizarre. And I don't know. I mean, obviously Martin Lewis has done some great stuff, but he does come across as somewhat bombicious. I'd definitely go that far. And Kemi comes out of the whole thing rather well.
Well, she does have to say, doesn't she? Because Ed Balls piles in as well. Mm. And she just has to say, stop talking over me. I'm the guest. I need to say what I've been asked to say. At which point both gentlemen do slightly pipe down.
That's good
of them. I think she comes out of it rather well. And you're right. There's just something very weird when people on that very formulaic television set move out of their place, because you just don't see that happening very often.
It never happens. And so I'm contradicting myself, really. It's good when it does. Let's freshen up television a bit. Come on. Start being a bit more inventive. Get off your sofas. Just get random.
Just wander around shouting.
Yeah, just wandering around shouting will catch on at some point. Right. Let's talk the by-election, because it is going to be quite a week potentially for Sir Keir Starmer. Maybe it'll end quite well for him. Who knows? We should say as well, we'd love you to get involved this afternoon. The WhatsApp is 0333 003 2353. He has spent yesterday, in fact, we're told, campaigning in Gorton and Denton ahead of the by-election. Now, this is being pitched by some people as make or break for his leadership of the government. There's speculation that the Greater Manchester seat could go to Reform UK or to the Greens. We've got an inside look at how voters there feel about being under the microscope.
I'm annoyed that it has to happen. I'm annoyed that it has to happen, basically. Because, like I said, our councillors are the ones who do stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the people who want to become MPs for Gordon Levy and everyone, it's for them. It's not about us. It's about them.
I'm a bit anxious about it, to be honest with you. I think there's just so much, like, in the media.
It's almost as if you can't actually pick Labour. It's off the table. It's as if they've been wiped completely. It's literally Reform or the Green Party.
This is a local by-election.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people are being brought into a national debate. Mm-hmm. So it's not focusing on local issues as it is focused on divisive parties against one another.
Well, there are extracts, from focus groups by an organisation called GGF Insights, the research arm of the Good Growth Foundation. And the strategy director of that organisation is Louisa Dollimore. Louisa, it is interesting, isn't it, that some of these people living their lives feel somewhat got at because the by-election is happening and they're being scrutinised and their area is being scrutinised in a way they don't much like.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I think this is absolutely true, and it's not uncommon in by-elections that people feel their kind of local election has been taken over by national politics. But at the same time, I think it's probably worth noting that in these focus groups, what we saw was that a lot of this is a vote on national issues. So on the Green switcher side, for example, these are people who voted Labour in 24 and are now undecided between Labour and the Green Party. They very much said that if they vote Green locally, this will be a national protest vote against Labour. It will be about sending a message. And on the Labour Reform side, this was not dissimilar to the Green side, an expression of frustration about a lack of change, a sense they voted for change and it hasn't been delivered yet. And also a vote very much on the kind of single issue of their concern, which is immigration.
Can you tell us how you put together these focus groups? I've got to say that in the clip we've just played, everyone sounds pretty disgruntled. Did you come across some people who were quite chirpy?
So the groups are two different groups. One is Labour Green switchers and one is Labour Reform switchers. That means they're undecided between those two parties. It's fair to say, I think, you know, disgruntled across the board is probably a reasonable way of describing how they feel at the moment. There's a lot of dissatisfaction in politics generally and a lot of distrust in politics generally, a sense that politics is for politicians, not for voters. And that comes out quite interestingly in their sentiment towards, for example, Nigel Farage. So in the Labour Reform switcher group, despite the fact they, you know, they did feel Farage represented the issues that they cared about, represented their concern on immigration, at the same time, you know, there was a sense that maybe he's in it for himself, he's in it for the publicity, like a lot of politicians they feel are.
Let's delve a little bit deeper into what you've been able to collect then. We're going to listen now to the issues driving voters, and we'll begin with that group you mentioned, those people thinking about going green.
I think I'd say cost of living.
Okay.
I understand they have to be taxed. I understand that's how we get money into the system. I understand that's how you fund the NHS. I get all those things. But I do feel like I'm getting, taxed and taxed and taxed. And the cost of living's just going up and up and up.
You know, a later retirement age, taxing your savings, etc., etc., etc. None of it appeals to the general population. I'm not saying that you can do things radically because obviously they've got to raise money. But they've got to be careful that they don't end up being so far away from the people that would normally put them into power that they'll never get back in.
It is interesting, isn't it? And we shouldn't be surprised. In the end, it is about how much your food shop every week is going to set you back. And I think food price inflation is running at 3.5%, something like that. This is the reality. You can talk about big picture politics, but ultimately people care about whether they've got any spare money at the end of the week or month.
Yes, you're completely right. And, you know, some listeners might even be surprised to hear the Green voters there talking about their concerns on tax. There is an overwhelming sense, and this came out in both groups, and it comes out in all the research we do, actually, that the system is broken, that no matter how hard you work, you don't get more out of it. It's a pay more, get less economy. And you've got the cost of living crisis stifling people. You've got our public services more and more stretched. This is really a universal sentiment. And what's perhaps most interesting is that it's the same sentiment, the same anxiety about the cost of living that drives a lot of the concern on immigration. So it's the same concern across both groups. It's just that in the reform switcher group, it's expressed through this lens of immigration.
Yeah, well, let's hear from them. Here are the reform curious.
Illegal immigration.
Illegal immigration. Anything else? Or?
I think another big thing, I think what I think you touched on earlier on, which is a huge issue in Devon and across Manchester, really, is like housing. You know, I think it's become incredibly unaffordable for people. I feel sorry for young people. You know, for one, if you're having to rent somewhere, the rents have gone through the roof. I mean, I moved here 10 years ago. And the rents have, like, almost doubled.
Yeah. The cost of living, I would definitely put on the government.
Right, okay.
You know, the petrol situation, you know, how much we pay now for petrol is an absolute joke.
And which political party do you think are most likely to reduce the cost of living, to target utility bills, to make these changes?
None of them.
And that's the problem. They don't actually trust any of the parties to sort out their very real issues. Really struck there by the man who said his rent had almost doubled. We don't often talk about rents going up. It's not just young people renting. Plenty of people my age and slightly younger and way beyond are renting, and there are real problems for them.
Yes, absolutely. You're completely right. This all feeds into that, you know, kind of really strong, overwhelming sense that things are just getting harder and harder. In relation to bills, for example, people describe them as a black hole. They just get bigger and bigger, and no matter how much you throw into them, there's always more that will be asked for. Housing is not dissimilar, and there's real concern about the fact that people don't have any control over their futures, over how much these bills will go up, over how much their rent, their mortgage might go up. And this is, you know, as I said, it's quite striking how much this is similar across the two groups.
OK, let's just bring in some more views from the Reform Curious. Here we go.
It takes a long time to change things.
Right.
But our news keeps going, they've not done this, they've not done that. You can't change stuff overnight. You know. But it's as if the Tories weren't in ever.
For the last couple of years, all we've heard is this 20 billion black hole that we've inherited. If I hear that one more time, I think I'll scream.
The only thing with Labour is I think it's sometimes it's just better the devil, you know, because they're all crap.
Yeah.
And I was like that, like, do we just stick to what we know? But then you've got to give them a chance.
Right. I mean, I detected some sympathy for Labour there. Not much, but a little bit, Louisa. What do you say?
Yeah, you can always trust a focus group to say it like it is. I think that's fair. And sympathy for Labour, a little. Basically, if Labour managed to win this election, it will be partly because voters are trying to balance their expressing their frustration with risk. So on the Labour Green side, you know, it's we do want a protest vote. We want to gear the National Labour Party, national government in a different direction. Therefore, we might vote Green to send a message. But at the same time, we really don't want to let reform in. And, you know, on the reform side, actually, there are concerns about a new leader, whether he would be able to govern. As you heard there, I think she said, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. So, you know, it's really voters are kind of trying to balance up this risk with how they express it. In this election, the Greens, the Green switchers will be what decide the outcome, whether that's messaging, that sense that if they don't vote Labour, they might let reform in. Whether that is successful will dictate the outcome.
I mean, surely turnout is going to be a big issue as well. I mean, the weather is slightly better in London today. I don't know what it's set to do in that part of Greater Manchester on Thursday. But if, I mean, turnout in this part of the world, probably not enormously high in a general election. What do you think about turnout?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it always does have a huge impact on the outcome. I think that turnout could be potentially helpful for Labour, but we just have to wait and see.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's not... The voter who said we're sort of pretending that Labour's not an option, or we've been told that Labour's not an option, there's actually a chance that Labour will win the seat, isn't there?
Yeah, she was quite fascinating, actually, as a participant. She sparked a conversation in the groups about this, because actually she was expressing a level of frustration that the message that was very much being hammered home to her was it's Greens or reform. And she's obviously got that messaging through the Green squeeze leaflets that are coming through their door. So it's interesting that that has hit home. But she was also kind of saying later on in the group, well, hang on, Labour is an option. I can vote for Labour if I want to. So, you know, one thing that kind of came across in all of them was they were going, we've had so many people knocking on our door. We've had so many leaflets through. We really feel we're being tugged in three directions. And what's kind of extraordinary is we're looking at a by-election where it really could go any one of three ways.
Yes, OK, which is why political nerds are fascinated by this. Ryan, I'm going to go to the final clip, if that's all right. There's a bit of production there going on just because we're running out of time. There was a warning for Reform UK from a few voters who actually were, broadly speaking, sympathetic to them.
I am steering to voting for Reform, but there is some parts that I don't like. And I've seen a few racist things, not from Reform, but what other people have commented, and that puts me off them.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? So I do agree with some of the stuff they say, but then when people put in racist things, I'm like, I don't want to be associated if that's what people think. So it's a bit of a hard one.
That's quite an interesting point, isn't it, Louisa? The idea that Reform UK are not themselves saying racist things, but their rise does appear to have encouraged some racist opinions.
Yeah, absolutely. Racism was a word that came up a lot in the Labour Reform switcher group. Yes, there was, it was expressed that, you know, there was a concern that it would allow kind of racist views, even if they weren't expressing them themselves. But there were also participants in the group who felt they were expressing racist views, the politicians themselves. And what I think is most interesting is that it fed into us as kind of distrust, a kind of, oh God, is this too much of a risk to put our vote with reform? Is it too uncertain? What if it creates a kind of culture and a kind of society that we're not actually happy with? So it feeds into that level of uncertainty that people are feeling about Farage as a leader and about, you know, is it better to go with the devil you know and the devil you don't?
I'm really putting you on the spot here, but Louisa, who's going to win?
From a focus group, you can never say who's going to win. What you can say is what's driving public sentiment, what's driving people in one direction or another. What I will say is that the Labour-Green switchers are going to decide the outcome of this election, and whether they stick or whether they switch will determine whether Labour win it or whether Reform win it, I suspect, or whether the Greens do.
Right. Okay. Yes. It's a very much a race with three horses in it. Thank you. Louisa Dolmore, Strategy Director for the Good Growth Foundation. And of course, you can go to all the usual places to find out exactly who's standing. I would suggest whocanivoteFor.co.uk is a good place to start.
Coming up, we'll be discussing everything you need to know before you book your tickets to the World Cup. If that is you, you'll want to stay with us. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Kate Borsay on Times Radio. Prepare for a lively mix of illuminating conversation, telling the stories that matter, alongside a world-class lineup of guests, experts and contributors. There's a merry band of erudite intellectuals who join us every evening, Michael Binion.
We had a very interesting meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch.
Zoe Strimple.
There is real unease.
And Peter Hitchens, to name a few.
This is war, for goodness sake. Nobody tells the truth about what's going on.
Kate Borsay, tonight from 7 on Times Radio.
For the ones who share everything, even their last chocolate, this Mother's Day, show your appreciation with a gift from Hotel Chocolat that's just for them. Give a box bursting with all their favourites, from exuberantly fruity creations to desserts and cocktails transformed into chocolate. Or share even more quality time together over a hot or cold drinking chocolate with the all-new Velvetizer. Imaginative gifts await, in-store and online, at Hotel Chocolat.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Right now, the kitchen and bathroom sale is on. There are options to suit every budget and every home. Browse all the kitchen and bathroom sale offers at wix.co.uk.
Hang out the bunting. It's World Cup Esther Day. If you're planning to head to the US this summer for the World Cup, now is the time to get your travel paperwork sorted. It might sound a bit complicated, but fear not. Times Holidays can help fans navigate everything from the paperwork to the perfect itinerary. Claire Irvin is head of travel at the Times and the Sunday Times. Hello, Claire.
Hi.
Why is it so important that fans get their Esther applications in sooner rather than later?
Well, there's some very good reasons. There's Easter coming up, so it's going to be really busy. There'll be lots of people who aren't going to the football but are going for Easter, busy time, lots going on. And there will be an awful lot of people who forget to get their Esther. So actually, Esters normally are a few hours to 72 hours. They're pretty good. Many as the visit where I've been sat there at 2 o'clock in the morning praying that it comes through, and it does. But I just don't think the World Cup is the time to be doing that. So half term's over. Planning for your next trip.
Yeah, no excuse at all. Just get on with it.
No excuse. Just do it.
Is there a time limit by which you can no longer apply? Does it a kind of gate shut down on you at any time?
No, they don't. But I think it's something that I, as a travel editor, often overlook. And so I'm just trying to warn other people not to forget. And I do think there'll be a backlog. I really do. Because apart from anything, I think there'll be a lot of people who haven't got tickets for the World Cup that suddenly think, hang on a minute, it's America, it's the World Cup, and just want to be there soaking up the atmosphere. There's quite a lot going on in all of the host cities. They're pretty amazing host cities. So if you just get that bit out of the way, yeah, that's one less thing
be
to worry
sensible
about.
Just absolutely be sensible, kids.
But you are right, of course, if you are booking with a travel agent, they will be able to help that, and we now have travel agents at the Times.
That's amazing. Okay, mm-hmm. So we are just here to help, Claire, aren't we?
We're just everything we can do.
What should be on fans' to-do lists while they're there? Because it would be a shame to go all that way and only see football.
Absolutely. And, well, I mean, the host cities are just a long list of superlatives, as you might imagine, being in the US. You know, there's Atlanta, busiest airport. I'm not sure that's necessarily a draw. Kansas has got the loudest stadium. So even if you've not got tickets, you'll be able to partake. But there's Boston, Dallas, Houston, Seattle. I was there earlier this year, and that's going to have a whole new waterfront array of attractions. But even without that, it's pretty cool. And so each of those cities are really polishing up their act in terms of, all the attractions. And then there's festivals, there's events going on, there's big fan areas where you can go and watch without a ticket. So yeah, I think, I mean, I think if you're out there, you've got to try and watch a bit of football, even if it's, you know.
Oh, definitely, just, yeah. Definitely. The news that comes from America, the stuff that we report, the stuff that makes the headlines can be quite dark. It can make you feel quite unsafe. We were reporting only yesterday about the drug cartel situation in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So how do you assess that change in safety now?
So we follow the FCDO advice to the letter because, quite bluntly, if you travel when the foreign officers don't travel, you're not insured. So we take that as our benchmark. And actually, Mexico today, they're saying it's not safe to travel to quite a few areas. Now, obviously, we hope that's going to change by the summer. But
if it didn't change by the summer, would that mean that it was unwise to go?
Absolutely. You'd have no insurance. But what it would mean as well is that if you are travelling with a tour operator, you can request you can go to a different destination, you can cancel. So you would be covered then, and you would be insured as well.
You may not know the answer to this question, so I'm sorry to dole it out to you, but I'm sure that some people at home will be shouting at the radio. What would happen in a situation where you saw something like what happened in Minneapolis in America, where a city in the city centre became an incredibly difficult and dangerous place to be, actually? Does the Foreign Office make those kind of specific points of, geographically unsafe to go to?
A
very small place can be named by the Foreign Office.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at Mexico today, you'll see that actually it's quite patchy in terms of where that advice is, and there's really localised areas. And, you know, we've seen violence breaking out in Tulum and some of the more touristy areas today. Those are still okay to travel to, but I think if I was going on holiday to Mexico, which indeed I am meant to be later this year, I would be looking very closely and keeping an eye on that.
Are flights likely to go up before they come down?
They
won't come down.
No.
Okay, they're just going to go up and stay up.
Get them now, yeah. If there's any left, get them now.
Okay.
It's dynamic pricing, so we'll see. They're priced on demand, and if there's just a couple of seats left, they're definitely not going to be flogging them cheap.
Okay, but there wouldn't be a situation whereby the airlines would think, well, everybody who wants to go has booked their flight, so we'll have a little bit of a lull.
No.
Right. Fair enough. I like a very simple answer to a very straightforward question. Just get on and do it. Tell us a little bit more about how the Times can help now.
Well, the Times now has its own travel agency, Times Holidays. So, which is pretty unique because it's completely driven by what we do editorially. What we do editorially is impartial. It's independent. Everything that we recommend has been tested by us rigorously, I might say. Check out the section this weekend to see how rigorous. That's all I'll say. There's a little treat in store. So you know, as somebody who books through Times Holidays, that we've been and we approve of that editorial supplier. You might come through one of our features. And then the experts we have handling calls and emails will be able to book you that itinerary, book with that partner. And you know what? It's human as well. And recommended and expert and accountable.
We love human. We love human.
We love human. I love accountable even more, actually.
Yeah, and I love a travel person who's been to the place that they're telling you about. You cannot beat that. Claire, thank you very much indeed. Claire Evans, Head of Travel at The Times and The Sunday Times. If this chat has given you the travel bug, we do have an exciting competition on Times Radio in association with Times Holidays, the new service from The Times that Claire was talking about. You could win a fantastic week for two on the beautiful island of Madeira, staying in a traditional quinta. The package includes flights and transfers and is worth more than £5,000. For your chance to win this great prize, courtesy of Times Holidays, simply search online for Times Radio Competitions. The entry form is on the website. The competition closes at midnight on March the 19th, and all of the T's and C's are online. Did I get Quinta right? Quinta? 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 Yeah. Okay, thank you. Good luck.
What is it? A house? Yes. We'll take it as a kind of a house.
A dwelling.
A dwelling place.
A Madeiran dwelling.
Oh, wonderful. Right. Okay. Thank you, Claire. You're with Times Radio. Slightly late to the headlines, we apologise, but after you hear from Laura Cook, we'll be discussing why there still aren't enough women at the top of British business. Here is Laura with the headlines.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Sir Ed Davey says Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has shamed our country as he calls for documents relating to his appointment as UK trade envoy to be released. It's a role he held for 10 years until 2011 and now faces accusations he passed sensitive information to Jeffrey Epstein during that time. Last week, he was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. He's previously denied wrongdoing. The Lib Dem leader says it's time for transparency.
Whether it is the President of the United States or Peter Mandelson and Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, their victims and survivors have seen those responsible evade accountability for far too long.
The Russian president has accused Ukraine of trying to sabotage the peace process. It's exactly 4 years since the Kremlin ordered its tanks across the border as part of what it called a special military operation. Russell Brand has pleaded not guilty to two further sexual offences, including an alleged rape in 2009. The former comedian's previously denied all other charges against him. The Ministry of Justice is going to increase the use of artificial intelligence in courts to cut backlogs. The minister in charge, David Lammy, says it'll be for things like keeping notes and summarising judgments. And a Labour MP is writing to the BBC for more information about how a racial slur was broadcast during the BAFTA Awards. Tourette's campaigner John Davidson could be heard shouting as Cine stars Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo presented an award. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your new service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Step out of your ordinary and discover something new on a Cunard voyage from Hayes Travel. Book selected 2026 and 2027 voyages before the 2nd of March and enjoy 10% off. That's 10% off the Norwegian fjords, transatlantic crossings, Europe, the Caribbean and more. This offer must end March the 2nd, so book your Cunard voyage with a low deposit at Hayes Travel today. Conditions apply. At all protected.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix. Ready to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom? If you'd like a personalised design, the Wix free design service can guide you through the whole process, including a free home measure. Book today at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar, yes?
Oh, I was just going to say that Peter's cracked a superb joke. Surely all flights go up before they come down. Thank you, Peter. Well spotted.
Well, hopefully.
And, yep. And Quinta is a farm.
Thank you. we do depend on you, the listener, to guide us through the afternoon. Okay, John Pienaar with news of his programme between 4 o'clock and seven. And the Defence Secretary has spoken exclusively to John, in fact, on the fourth anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And here he is saying he wants to be the Defence Secretary that deploys British troops to Ukraine.
Every conflict, every war has to end in negotiation. I want to see 2026, the year that this war does end. I want to be the Defence Secretary that deploys UK troops into Ukraine, because that will mean we've got a negotiated peace in place. And I want Britain to continue, just as we have in supporting Ukraine in the fight, I want to see us leading the support for Ukraine to secure that peace for the long term, because in the end, after the end of the fighting, it will be Ukraine that is its own best way of defending and deterring any future Russian aggression.
That's John Healey, Defence Secretary, and you can hear the interview in its entirety on Drive with John from four. He does make very clear that British troops will only be deployed after peace has been achieved. But there's no sign of it, is there, really?
No. Well, I spoke to John Healey and some others at the Ukrainian Catholic Cathedral earlier today. And what you heard him say there was really what we all want to see. We want to see an end to the war. We want to see a free Ukraine. We want to see a Ukraine somehow secure from the threat of Vladimir Putin's aggression. But getting there from where we are now is a fiendishly difficult job, and not just for the enormous task of coping with the military assault of Vladimir Putin, the politics of all of this. You've got on one side an American president who, frankly, is not especially helpful, who's looking for a peace on any terms, which in practice means terms that are going to be acceptable to Moscow. He leans on Zelensky. He does not lean on Putin. And Healey, as you'll hear, he can't say really these things out loud. He has to keep looking on the, the positive side. He doesn't want to further alienate Trump. So there's a kind of a dance around that subject, which you can hear with Healy. Mm. I often think, how can we really understand what's going on in Ukraine? I mean, if you haven't experienced war, and we have not, how can you really grasp it, let alone in its rawest form that we see every day in Ukraine? So today's show is pretty much all about that and bringing that home as far as it's possible to people people listening to the show. So I'm going to be talking to two soldiers. We're hearing from two soldiers from the front line and the combat front line, which you don't hear very often, about their experiences. I'm talking to three women about their lives in Ukraine and how it's been transformed, how they cope with that. You'll hear from a four-year-old girl who just tells us how, when the drones come in, she hides under the duvet, under the covers, to get away from it, but sounds remarkably calm for all of that. She says her life is calm. And so many other things as well. The bishop, the Ukrainian bishop, he talked to me about the way the cathedral is now a centre for Ukrainians for spiritual guidance and comfort, but also a kind of just a place to meet and have a cup of tea and share the sort of comfort that people need.
Yeah, I mean, we've stopped being shocked by what you just said about Trump only leaning on one side of this argument. I mean, it's not really, there isn't any one side of the argument, which is Ukraine's. They were invaded. But Zelensky's always the one put under pressure by Trump. And frankly, I have stopped being appalled. And I should continue to be appalled, shouldn't I?
It is appalling. It's appalling.
It is appalling, yeah.
And in a way, Volodymyr Zelensky is much more open about stating the reality of this now than he used to be. And European leaders, in their way, are pretty clear about it, though sometimes using fairly careful language. It is the reality. And you can't really get Donald Trump in a worse mood, for want of a better word, than he is at the moment, if you can avoid it. And they do try and avoid it. They still need him in so many ways for a security guarantee, as and when a ceasefire comes along, for example. But it's like skating on the thinnest of ice, and the ice is laying over layers of dynamite. It couldn't be more difficult or delicate. But that's what they do and what they need to do.
Thank you, John. That's John Pienaar with news of his programme from 4 o'clock today here on Times Radio. It's worth saying it is the State of the Union address today in the States, and Donald Trump will be giving it in the early hours of our tomorrow morning, and you can hear that at 2 o'clock tomorrow morning here on Times Radio. I think Tom Noonan
is staying up all night, isn't he?
One of the shorter straws.
Well, I think he's a very enthusiastic news bunny, so he may say it as quite an appropriately long straw, Jane.
Right, OK, yes, of course. The glass is always half full in the dizzy world of news. So, Tom, here on Times Radio.
I don't think you can keep Tom away from a State of the Union address.
You probably can't. Taking you through the night, you won't miss a trick here on Times Radio. Could our next guest, would you mind, Vivian, I really hate to do this to you, could you move to the other microphone? Does that make sense? I'm really sorry. This is very informal. You don't need to worry about anything. We are going to talk now about women at the top of British business. The UK is often described as a global leader when it comes to making sure that women do have a place in the boardroom. Women now hold around 43% of board roles across the FTSE 350, and nearly 9 in 10 companies have hit or are close to hitting the 40% target. But when it comes to the very top job, progress does appear to have stalled. There were 9 female CEOs in the FTSE 100 last year, and that's exactly the same as the year before. So why aren't women becoming chief executives, and why is that 40% target not being hit across the board? Well, Vivian Arts is CEO of the FTSE Women Leaders Review. Good afternoon.
Lovely to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
It's very, very good to see you. So why do you think it hasn't really changed all that much? I mean, there's been huge progress, but right at the very, very top, it's a bit, what do you think?
Well, is it right at the very, very top? I think there are a number of roles at the top, and that's why we selected the 4 key roles as the areas of focus: the chair, the CEO, the finance director, and the senior independent director. And you're absolutely spot on. The progress in relation to the CEO role has been slow. In 2021, we had 8, and in 2025, we have 9 now in the FTSE 100, which is not exactly astronomical progress. It's not the progress that we've seen in relation to other areas. We do focus on the CEO role because there are so few, because the media focuses on the CEO role, because every time we talk about a CEO and they happen to be a woman, we say, and it's a female CEO. And then we ask other questions that are completely irrelevant to the role.
Okay, well, let's tackle that. They are scrutinised in a very different way, aren't they?
They are. They are. And I think it makes it very difficult to succeed in that role when you're being asked things that are perhaps not relevant, or things that are personal, things that men wouldn't otherwise be asked. And what we should be doing is really measuring those women on their track record in that role as the actual CEO. But if we want to know why we don't have more female CEOs, I think part of it is actually looking at the pipeline and how do we build the talent pipeline to make sure that we do have more so that we're not focused on this very, very small number going forward, but actually we have that full breadth of talent at the top of UK business, setting strategy and setting culture. And part of that is to do with the fact that we don't have as many women in those P&L or revenue generating roles, heading up business lines at the point in their career when they're ready to be considered for that next step.
Yeah, I mean, those of us who've not worked in business, certainly not at anything like the level that you have, I know. What kind of jobs within a company are more natural precursors to becoming the boss, the big boss? What kind of role would you need to have performed to one day be in with a chance of running the whole thing?
Being the head of sales, being the chief financial officer, having responsibility for building the business, having that customer interaction. And that's why we call them revenue generating roles. You're in a role that's actually generating revenue for your company as opposed to the internal general counsel or the head of compliance or even the CIO, although one has to ask in this digital age whether
or not chief information officer,
yeah, whether actually they shouldn't be being groomed for these roles, given that everything is increasingly digital within organisations and that transformation that's taking place.
But are there lots of female CIOs?
There is an increasing number of female CIOs, but long way from being at 50%. And we have been tracking the functional roles, which are the roles where, you know, you're doing an important job within the business, but it isn't a revenue generating role. And we do find that women tend to over index in those roles, i.e. there are more women in those roles than in the revenue generating roles. So I think if we're serious about building the pipeline, if we're serious about seeing more female CEOs, then we need to be looking at how are we preparing our talent to make sure that they have the right exposure to the range of roles within an organization so that they are in that cohort that's there to be selected for CEO going forward.
Okay. Is the elephant in the room the fact that a woman who is going to give her life to a business role, and if you are the CEO, let's face it, you've got to live and breathe this 24/7, haven't you? She needs a supportive partner. Now, that partner may or may not be male. She may not have one at all. But if she has a man in her life, that man needs to be quite an unusual chap. What would you say?
It's really interesting. There's a fascinating book called Female Breadwinners, written by Dr. Suzanne Doyle Morris many years ago. And as a result of discussions in her coaching area with female breadwinners, she found that actually that was the single main ingredient to success was whoever your partner was, that they were actually supportive of the role that you were doing. So I think that's a really important part of it, is that a CEO role can be all-consuming. But I suppose the challenge there is actually how can we rearticulate? Does it have to be as all-consuming as it traditionally has been?
Well, tell me, is presenteeism in or out at the moment? Because it was very much in, then it was out for a bit. Is it back?
I think in certain sectors and different cultures, we're seeing that desire to go back to presenteeism. But the reality is, again, if we look at King's College London, for example, they're doing excellent work on flexible working. And that presenteeism is being proven not to be necessary for success. And I think if we can rearticulate how that looks like, what leadership looks like, how it can be represented and how it can be practiced in a successful way, I think then we can change the culture around it and make that role much more attractive to women.
Perhaps we should celebrate those women who have got to the top. And I'm just looking at the range. I can't name all of them, but people would be bored to tears. But Severn Trent, for example, Diageo, GSK. I mean, they're very different organisations. Why have they all done okay and had a female CEO? Is it possible to generalise?
I don't know if you can generalise, but I would say that well done to the chairs of those boards, because it's the board who selects the CEO and those chairs have shown vision. They have identified the top talent because those have all been very successful female CEOs in their different way. They've all faced challenges, enormous challenges in their organisations, but they've done an amazing job. So the credit goes to, and I have to do a shout out for all the men, because at the end of the day, how did change happen as a result of the FTSE Women Leaders Review? Basically, most chairs were men, and it's those men that have been driving the change, understanding that the breadth of talent is essential to building resilient organizations, and having that diversity of thought and experiences is so critical. So it's actually those boards that are showing the leadership by looking for the talent to make sure that they get women and diversity of thought in those leadership roles.
But because I guess there are so few women, relatively speaking, at the very top, if something goes belly up on her watch, then, I mean, everything hits the fan, doesn't it? And then you probably would see it filtering down to other women not getting the opportunity.
it's interesting is that that whole glass cliff thing, which is often that women are invited in to take a role where a lot of the men might step back because it's high risk, but it's the only opportunity you're going to have. So it is high risk. I think we need to just, again, look at this in a much more balanced way. Men and women succeed actually not in very different ways. But we always focus on the bad news story. And I think there is a very good news story here as well, which is that there is success and that role modeling is important. But the only way we're going to increase that role modeling is if we start looking at talent in a different way. What is the criteria for CEO? Are we always looking for someone who's done the job previously? Mm. Or are we actually looking for a fresh approach, fresh eyes in an incredibly disruptive world, a world where there's no precedent for a lot of what we're encountering? I think we should be looking at people who've got a range of skills.
Can I just ask about whether actually I've completely forgotten what I was going to ask you. Hang on, it's quite a pivotal point. And I
while
can't remember
you
it. Yes.
Recall that, while can I'm I fumbling. Just step in and ask you whether it is still the case that companies that do have an equal distribution of women at the top actually do better in terms of their profit margins and their success?
That's what I was going to ask.
Oh my goodness!
Well, there we go. Great minds think alike.
Yeah. Good partnership.
Well, isn't it interesting that the companies that perform the best are the FTSE 100 because they have the best results. And they also have the best gender representation, both on boards and in leadership.
So money talks and it's saying something, isn't it?
It does. And the results are there just for everyone to see.
Do you know, I do think that the point is fascinating about how to celebrate the supportive partner of somebody right at the very top of any profession. And actually, we've got so much work to do on that, haven't we? And if we can celebrate what I think society would call the beta male a little bit more, we'd be in an awful lot better place, full stop, wouldn't we? But we slightly take the mick, I think, still. And that powerful, powerful alpha male stretch that's going on at the moment is really damaging.
Yeah, I think we see some really scary examples of that out there at the moment. But what's interesting, in a moment of crisis, what did we see coming to the fore? So during the pandemic, we saw it was a lot of those female leaders had the ability to lead in uncharted territory, when you couldn't connect with your people in person, when there was a global crisis going on, when people were struggling to do their work and also struggling to cope at home. And actually, it's been interesting to see a lot of those behaviours, the emotional intelligence, the ability to connect with people was so important to bringing organisations together.
Does money matter? Because I think women have got a part to play in this, actually. I'm appalled when I see the salaries of some of these female CEOs. Like, what? She's earning £21 million a year. But I wouldn't be as indignant if it were a man. So I'm in the mix here and I'm to blame for this. Can I get over myself, Vivian?
Oh, you're going to have to get over yourself.
Okay, all right.
they deserve every penny.
Well, spirited. Thank you very much. Thank you, Defee, for helping me out. The mind just went blank, but you've got to acknowledge it sometimes. There's no point pretending. Vivian, lovely to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Here for you, sister.
Thank you. Vivian Art, CEO of the FTSE Women Leaders Review.
Very nice to meet you too. Coming up, should GPs be prescribing more weight loss drugs? The government seems to think so. It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. All the latest national and international breaking news and informative interviews. Plus, hear unrivaled journalistic expertise and detailed analysis on the radio programme where sharp insight meets original thinking. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. This afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with ServiceNow, the AI control tower for business reinvention. Find out more at servicenow.com.
Listen to Times Radio at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Health news now. GPs are being offered bonuses to speed up the prescription of weight loss drugs. Ministers want to ensure that patients who would benefit from the drugs are able to access them. Let's talk about this with our resident GP, Dr. Rachel Ward, also co-host of the Pharmacy Podcast. Rachel, how much might you be offered and how does that work? Because surely as a GP, you aren't not prescribing Mounjaro, and that's the drug in question, when you think it needs to be given, just because you haven't been incentivised yet.
Good afternoon. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely right. We are not just prescribing this drug if we are being given, as it's being couched, a bonus. What it is that we are being asked to set up services within our practice where we can prescribe people weight loss drugs, namely Mounjaro, as you've said, but also provide that ongoing support of adjusting doses, you know, helping people with their diet and lifestyle and giving really good weight loss input, a holistic service to people. So it's not just about prescribing the drugs. Now, of course, that takes time, that takes people power to deliver this service. And actually, the amount of money that we're talking about is minimal. So the maximum for a practice, I believe, is £3,000. I'm not sure if that's based on actual numbers of patients in your whole population. I think we're looking at about £1,500 in our practice. And that money is to set up a service, and it's not something that's going to be ongoing. But let's think about how many people are going to access this, because West Streeting has been saying, for example, you know, we are investing in general practice and this will help bring this modern medicine to the many and not the few. Well, in my practice, we have over 18,000 patients and we ran a search to see how many of our patients meet the criteria to have this prescribed. And we came up with 4 patients out of 18,000. So at the moment, the problem with this rollout is nothing to do with GPs not doing it, GPs, you know, and bonus payments. It's about the fact that the criteria for us to prescribe it are ridiculously tight.
Right. And admittedly, we are flabbergasted by that. So from 18,000 patients, only 4 jump over all of the hurdles needed to get to the end of the Mounjaro line. But let me ask you this, Rachel, how many do you think have gone and just bought weight loss drugs and taken them privately? Because I bet that there are more than 4 people on weight loss drugs amongst your 18,000 patients.
Yeah, I don't know the exact figure in our practice, but I will tell you that every single day I receive notification of patients being prescribed weight loss drugs privately. So there are many hundreds, I would imagine, over our 18,000. Yeah, and of course, we do prescribe it to people with diabetes. That's a whole different protocol and criteria. But talking specifically about the weight loss at the moment, The number of conditions that you have to have to meet the NHS GP target is incredibly strict. And we have a huge number of our patient population who are obese, but they're just not meeting that target. So it needs to be sped up to kind of open this up more.
Yep. Do you know what? We could have just a single weekly segment on weight loss drugs,
couldn't we?
And we'd still need a bit more time to talk about them. Yeah. I want to squeeze in a couple of other stories, though, while you're here this week, Rachel. The first woman in the UK has given birth via a donated womb from a deceased donor. This is an uplifting story, isn't it? But of course it's tinged with sadness.
Of course. I mean, whenever we talk about transplant of any organ, there is the wonderful outcome of changing somebody's life. But that comes from incredible generosity and sadness, the fact that somebody has given up their organs. So, you know, this is the first case where a baby has been born from a donated womb from a dead donor. We have had a baby born previously in the UK where a womb was donated from a living donor. But so this is a first. It is incredible science, incredible medicine. And I just think the team behind this, it just absolutely blows my mind. I think we have some incredible medics in this country, and this kind of thing really deserves to be celebrated. I mean, it's a joint venture between Oxford and London hospitals. Isabel Kroger in Oxford is the transplant surgeon and Richard Smith is the gynaecologist in London. And this work has been funded at the moment by the charity Womb Transplant UK. But there is potential and there is hope, I think, from this team that this in the future may be something which is available on the NHS for certain people.
A womb isn't on the usual list of organs to be donated after death, is it?
No. So at the moment, that is, if you are giving permission for organ donation, that is not on that list of organs. This has really been carried out as a completely separate kind of research entity with different consent being taken. I mean, that may change in the future, who knows, but certainly not at the moment. Mm.
And do you have to be a young woman to donate? I mean, our wombs change throughout our female lifetime, don't they?
Yeah, I'm not sure of the upper limit of age. I know in the last case where it was a living donor, I believe it was the woman's aunt that donated. I don't know what the age difference was there. But yeah, I would imagine that there is an upper limit, you know, for them to have a child.
It's fascinating frontier stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Quick thought on the latest shortage to be facing the NHS, which is bone cement, Rachel. Mm. Now, this is so important for all of those replacement operations, isn't it? What's happened?
It is. So, again, this is a case we were talking about hearing aid batteries a few weeks ago. This is a case where we have one main supplier for medical cement, Heraeus Medical, which is a German company, and they produce the cement which is needed for joint replacements, mainly used for knees, but also to an extent in hips, shoulders. And they had a break in their production, which is then going to lead to problems of supply. And bear in mind that we have over 1,000 operations a week which use this. This is going to be significant. And they supply 3/4 of the NHS medical cement. There is concern that this is going to have an effect on people or already having operation dates, already on the waiting list. And bear in mind, there are 850,000 patients on the waiting list in England for planned joint surgery at the moment. An unbelievable number. So, of course, if there's going to be any delays in getting those people sorted, that is a concern.
Right. That is going to be so dispiriting for people on that waiting list to hear this afternoon, Rachel. You're the bearer of bad news. It's not your fault, though. Always lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for your time. That is Dr. Rachel Ward, who is our resident GP. Julie makes an interesting point, and I'm sorry that we didn't have time to put it to Rachel. How many of the doctor's patients won't visit because they're afraid of a finger wagging? I know that's why I won't go to the doctors. Rachel Ward doesn't strike me as somebody who would be wagging a finger. Yes. But Julie, I do completely hear you. To get yourself into the room where you know you're going to be told something a little bit difficult.
Oh, it's one of the hardest things you can do.
It is one of the hardest things to do. And we think we're grown up about it, but we're not, are we?
No. But Julie, if you think you need to go, go on, make the appointment now. We know nothing, but we think you probably could, should. Yes, you can do it, Julie.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
3 o'clock now, it's Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you for another hour. And still to come, it's the fourth anniversary of the war in Ukraine. We'll hear from the UN Refugee Agency about the impact on ordinary Ukrainians. We'll talk sport, as we always do now, Monday to Thursday with Vassos Alexander. And today, one of Team GB's newly minted Winter Olympic medalists. And the crime writer and traitor star Harriet Tice joins us to talk about her new book. It's after 3:30, that interview. You won't want to miss Harriet. Here's the news at 3, Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. John Healey has told Times Radio he wants to be the defence secretary that puts UK boots on the ground in Ukraine. He says he wants to see the Russian war end this year, but accused President Putin of dragging his feet in peace talks. The defence secretary says if Moscow takes negotiations seriously, Britain is ready to secure peace for the long term.
I want Britain to continue just as we have in supporting Ukraine in the fight. I want to see us leading the support for Ukraine to secure that peace for the long term, because in the end, after the end of the fighting, it will be Ukraine that is its own best way of defending and deterring any future Russian aggression.
And you can hear that interview on Times Radio Drive with John Pienaar from 4 o'clock this afternoon. Trade Minister Chris Bryant has described Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor as rude, arrogant and entitled. Addressing the Commons, he criticised the former Duke as MPs demanded the release of files relating to his time as trade envoy. The government has said it's committed to release the files while warning it didn't want to jeopardise the police investigation. The minister said he called for Andrew to be sacked as trade envoy multiple times in 2011.
I doubt there is anyone in this House who is not shocked and appalled by the recent allegations. Colleagues and many civil servants have told me their own stories of their interactions with Mr. Mountbatten-Windsor, and they all betray the same pattern. A man on a constant self-aggrandizing and self-enriching hustle. A rude, arrogant, and entitled man who could not distinguish between the public interest, which he said he served, and his own private interest.
Andrew has denied any wrongdoing. Reddit has been hit with a £14 million fine for failing to keep children safe. An investigation found the social media platform didn't check ages properly and some may have been exposed to harmful content. The government's preparing to launch its justice plan, which is being seen as the biggest shake-up of criminal justice in 50 years. Blitz courts and trials without jury will aim to clear the mounting case backlog. The bill will be published tomorrow and expects to implement judge-only trials as early as 2028, despite criticism from lawmakers. Chocolate bars are the latest food item to be locked in plastic boxes at the shops. Police and retailers say there's been a surge in thefts, and it's not just because they have a sweet tooth. Industry experts say it's being resold to fund wider criminal activity. Christopher Noyce is from the Association of Convenience Stores and explains why it's become such a target.
It can be cleared off and resold, and it's actually gone from the third most targeted product, which was previously lots of opportunists and people just taking the odd chocolate bar, to actually now the second most targeted product in convenience stores behind only alcohol.
And a Labour MP is writing to the BBC for more information about how a racial slur was broadcast during the BAFTA Awards. Tourette's campaigner John Davidson could be heard shouting as Sinner stars Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo presented an award. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Times Radio app, online, and on your smart speaker.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
It is Fee Glover and Jane Garvey with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon here on Times Radio. Harriet Tice is going to join us after 3:30. She is a million copy best-selling novelist. Her novels are psychological thrillers. The fifth is out at the moment. It's called Witch Trial. Two girls accused of murder, a defence like no other. She did appear on the latest series of The Traitors, where she didn't tell people that she was a former barrister, but so many of the skills involved in being a barrister and certainly being in court are definitely relevant to being on The Traitors. Watching everybody, seeing the change of allegiances and sides, trying to piece together the evidence, trying to remain poker-faced yourself. So we've got plenty to talk about with Harriet after 3:30. A very interesting text has come in from Al. Do you want to do Al's?
Well, Al says, I'm currently 30 stone with high blood pressure and sleep apnea. I've been trying to lose weight, but I don't qualify for NHS treatment because, quotes, I'm too fit, according to my doctor. I do, however, qualify for and have been offered bariatric surgery, which is significantly more risky and expensive. I think that's crazy, says Al. That's interesting. I suppose, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Bariatric surgery does seem a dramatic potential solution. But as Al says, there are many risks and it's going to cost a lot. Whereas if Al could access Mounjaro, it might be helpful.
And this is what Rachel was alluding to, that out of their 18,000 patients, only 4 would qualify with the current criteria for weight loss drugs.
It's a statistic well worth remembering, that one, isn't it?
It is.
I mean, Rachel is a GP in sort of Oxfordshire area, I think. We'll check up on that. It might be that, I don't know, I mean, part of the world that... Would people be more likely to be more affluent and therefore less likely to be obese? What do you think?
Well, I don't know. We've got no way of knowing that at all. But I think what would be very interesting is to find out how many people have gone private and are buying the weight loss drugs. Mm. So making their own decision about their health and about the criteria that they need.
You were right earlier when you said that we could talk about this every single day.
We could.
Yeah, you really could.
Yep. We will make time to talk about it again, same time next week. And if there's anything that you'd like us to cover in our health slots and in our tech slots as well, then drop us an email, janeandfee@times.radio. Now, as the war in Ukraine enters its fifth year, President Zelensky says that Vladimir Putin has not achieved his goals. Sir Keir Starmer has pledged UK support for as long as it takes. The PM accused Moscow of blocking the path to peace and said it was losing the war.
In the last year, Russia has suffered
half a million casualties to gain and occupy less than 1% extra of Ukrainian territory. That is not a country that 4 years into a conflict is winning.
Well, on the ground, the human cost continues to mount and humanitarian needs remain vast. So let's talk about those with Elizabeth Hasland, who is Senior Communications Officer at UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, joining us from Kyiv in Ukraine this afternoon. Elizabeth, a very good afternoon from us in London. Just tell us a little bit about the mood there today, what people have talked about today, the feelings and the emotions in Kyiv.
Well, I think one of my Ukrainian colleagues said it very clear when she said it feels like that first night of the Russian invasion now 4 years ago has never ended. And that is really the reality here on the ground in Ukraine, that the war is just grinding on relentlessly with continued attacks. Last year, 2025, was actually the most deadly year for civilians since the start of the full-scale invasion. It was 4 days only during the entire year that there were no attacks, so 361 days with attacks on Ukraine. So it really shows that intensification of the war and the level of attacks that we've witnessed in the last couple of months, and that is continuing now in 2026. And of course it's affecting everyone in Ukraine. So it is what I hear from my colleagues, the people I meet here, you know, they are tired and they are exhausted after 4 years of this war.
And Elizabeth, what does living with that level of trauma for years do to a person?
Well, I mean, it is heartbreaking and harrowing stories I hear also when I travel around the country. One thing I think maybe it's not reported on so much is that even though we don't see big numbers of refugees leaving Ukraine, those big numbers were back in 2022, there are still people who are fleeing every single day from the front line, regions now. And I mean, the stories I hear when I've been to some of these transit centers that are being set up to receive people and where we are supporting from UNHCR side, you know, they're telling the stories about how their villages have become ghost towns. There were no neighbors left. There were no water, no electricity, no heating. There was no way where to buy bread anymore. So, you know, it's heartbreaking stories. We hear it also from the people who are living in the bigger cities where there is this constant threat of attacks. When will the next missile or drone hit? Will it be my building? So that constant insecurity about the future, I think, is really something that is characterizing the situation here in Ukraine and is, of course, affecting the mental health of people here.
The statements that are made by many world leaders, by our own Prime Minister in this country, they remain quite strong, they remain quite fierce, but the truth of the matter is they don't touch the sides with the man who really needs to be listening, who is Vladimir Putin. And I wonder what you can tell us about how Ukrainians that you spend time with think now about that kind of political leadership from the West.
Well, it's you know, as a humanitarian agency, it's not really my role to go too much into the politics. What I can say is that, you know, what I hear from the people is that they need peace and they hope for peace, and I think we can agree it's they need a just and a lasting peace, and I think what is also important is to note that, you know, the humanitarian situation, we need to remember that when there are all these news and negotiations on the peace and on these diplomatic talks, the reality on the ground here is that the humanitarian needs are immense. It's more than 10 million people across Ukraine who are in need of humanitarian aid. And these needs will actually also persist should we have a peace agreement tomorrow? Because the needs are so big. There are so many people displaced. 3 million homes have been destroyed since the start of the full-scale invasion. So the recovery will not happen overnight. So I think another, let's say, concern for us is, of course, the sustained international support for that humanitarian and recovery work. You know, the British public, the British government, companies and other donors, they have supported generously. But we are seeing globally that the support for humanitarian work across the world is diminishing. And that is, of course, also affecting our work here in Ukraine. So we do need that sustained support and solidarity. Now is not the time to look away from Ukraine.
Yeah, and our foreign aid budget is down, isn't it? As are some of our kind of contemporary countries and allies. Can I ask you, is there a conversation about rebuilding that is constantly going on with the notion that were peace to be achieved, a process could then immediately begin?
You know, I would actually say that some of the recovery and the rebuilding have started already. And I get this question quite a lot. People are saying, you are telling us the attacks are continuing. How can you also tell us about the recovery? How does that match up? And the fact is that people's lives don't stop. People cannot put their lives and the society on pause. So even if those attacks continue every single day, people are displaced every single day, there is an eagerness amongst the Ukrainian public, the government and authorities, and also local communities here to start that recovery process. So it's actually one part of the work we are doing, and others, of course, also here in Ukraine, already starting that recovery work. So, for example, we are helping to repair homes that have been damaged in the war. We've repaired 55,000 so far. And that, of course, helps the people who are here in Ukraine who wants to somehow continue their lives, even if the war continues. But this is also what will help pave the way for larger returns of refugees once the security situation will allow it.
Of course, living away from Ukraine presents its own problems, and so many of those people who left after the full-scale invasion couldn't possibly have imagined that they would still be at a point of refuge in this country or other countries, 4 years on. Do you know very much about how those communities have fared and are faring?
I mean, I'm not an expert on, for example, the Ukrainian refugees right now in the UK, for example. But we do in UNHCR do regular surveys amongst the Ukrainian refugees to check in on what is their situation and also what are their intentions and intentions for return. And that's also why we know that it is still the majority of Ukrainian refugees who want to return once it's safe enough to do so. And it's also from those surveys we know that that of course it's the security that plays a major role, but also factors like, will I have a roof over my head? Will I be able to get a job so I can provide for my family? Will there be basic services in place, schools for my children, so on? These are also things that will help people decide on their considerations for return. But one thing we can see, and that is one of the, let's say, more unfortunate learnings from these surveys and from some of our monitoring of people who are returning to Ukraine, because some people have returned to Ukraine, is we can also see some do that because they say that they don't have full access to healthcare in the countries where they have sought safety. So that, of course, speaks to the situation and the inclusion that, of course, needs to be in place for Ukrainian refugees who have left the country and sought safety elsewhere.
An interesting question from one of our listeners, Elizabeth. Our listener is Karen. She says, I was sending money regularly to Ukraine for humanitarian aid, but I got nervous with all of the talk of corruption. Now, Karen has asked, could you advise a safe place to send money? I'm not sure that it would be appropriate for me to ask you to do that, but I wonder about the wider point on corruption and whether you believe that that has hampered your work.
It's a good question, and of course we also followed here very intensely those reports and the unfolding of corruption allegations. you know, I can say very clearly, because I see it myself when I'm traveling around the country, I do see the results of our work. We are working very closely with Ukrainian NGOs here on the ground who are there in the front lines. They respond 30, 40 minutes after attacks to help the people who are affected by the aerial strikes. We also provide what we call cash assistance, but it's actually quite a, you know, it's not cash we give in the hand here. It's being delivered to people's accounts. This is support, vital support going straight to people's accounts. So, you know, no strange ways for that. So we do see that the aid is reaching the people who need it the most. But you know, there is, I think, one of the biggest challenges we see is really that the needs are so big. And even with the support we get to help us do our work, we simply cannot reach everybody in need, which is why we have to make the very difficult priorities sometimes on who to direct the aid to, because we can only reach that many people with what we have the funding for.
Thank you very much for talking to us this afternoon. That's Elizabeth Hasland, who's Senior Communications Officer at UNHCR in Kyiv.
And you're listening to Times Radio. Coming up next, a sport with Vassos Alexander. And we've got an Olympic medalist with Vassos in a moment or two. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. The kitchen and bathroom sale is now on. Explore all the sale offers at wix.co.uk or visit your local Wix store.
Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
It's a big night before we get on air, because Donald Trump will be delivering his State of the Union address. It'll finish around 4 a.m, so we'll bring you all the first reactions to whatever he says. And here's a tip, we've got no idea where he might go with it.
Yes, and nor does the Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Plus, the Times' Charles Curran and the former Conservative Minister Edwina Currie will talk us through the news of the day from 9. Times Radio Breakfast with Kate McCann and Stig Abel.
Tomorrow morning from 6 on Times Radio.
Step out of your ordinary and discover something new on a Cunard voyage from Hayes Travel. Book selected 2026 and 2027 voyages before the 2nd of March and enjoy 10% off. That's 10% off the Norwegian fjords, transatlantic crossings, Europe, the Caribbean and more. This offer must end March the 2nd, so book your Cunard voyage with a low deposit at Hayes Travel today. Conditions apply. At all protected.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrund and Patrick Maguire.
Only a very small handful of the people that I go out for lunch with will actually want to have a glass of wine. Nigel Farage is definitely one of them.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens, helping create kitchens to feel proud of. From expert design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan, through to a professional installation service. Learn more at wix.co.uk.
Are you running for Team GB or for Greece?
I suppose because it's the Olympics, I would have to run for Greece. So I don't mind.
That's good of you. But in his fantasies, he's Greek. What's the matter?
It's just the way you said that. Is he Greek in yours as well?
Listen, I'm knee-deep in a barrel of tarama salata in my dreams. Men don't figure.
Oh, that, Vassos, I'm sorry.
A humiliating incident occurred yesterday on this radio programme. Get rid of... Is it Zorba the Greek?
It is Zorba the Greek.
Yeah. All right, well, don't get above yourself. It's Vassos the Alexander with us do the sport. And we should say we've got a genuine Olympian with us and a medalist to boot. Zoe Atkin, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
And congratulations to you. I've just felt your bronze medal. I've just kind of... I mean, the weight of it. I mean, it's, I mean, you have to be quite fit just to wear one. You do.
Yeah, definitely a testament to the training I've been doing for the past 4 years, for sure.
Yeah.
But I literally haven't taken it off since I got it, so my neck is, like, a little bit sore.
Well, just watch that. You don't want to get an injury.
Problem to have.
Congratulations to you. It's brilliant. I think you can take over now.
Well, Zoe won a bronze medal, a slightly controversial bronze medal. Experts were saying it should have been at least silver in the ski slope style on the final morning of the Olympic Games on Sunday morning. So just 48 hours ago, barely. It capped the most successful Olympic Games and Winter Olympics for Team GB of all time. Three golds, the silver and this bronze medal. I mean, no wonder actually they're falling off the ribbons because they are quite, as you say, they are quite heavy. Now, normally people wouldn't really mind whether you finish second or third, a silver medal or a bronze medal. But for you, Zoe, I suspect you sort of do because of bragging rights at home.
Yes, my sister, my older sister, Isabel Atkins, she won a bronze medal in 2018 Olympic Games, and I was there watching her, and that was such a big moment, obviously for her, but for me, that was, you know, so inspiring, and she's the whole reason I got into the sport. And yeah, I definitely would have loved to one-up her, but it's okay. I'll take my bronze and, you know, we can compare them when I get home. But...
And there's always the French Alps in 4 years' time, right?
Exactly. That's 4 years away, we'll have to see, but... But yeah, maybe I'll one up her.
So tell us about the Olympic Games for you. So this is your first Olympic Games. You have in the back of your mind the fact that your sister won Team GB's. It was the first ever medal on snow, wasn't it, for Team GB that your sister Izzy won. And you've got, you know, you're the world champion. So you've got that sort of pressure. And you had to wait a flipping fortnight before you even got to ski.
Definitely. I mean, the Olympics are always just so hectic. There's so much going on. I mean, obviously it's, you know, the same event that we do at a World Cup or at, you know, our X Games events, but it's just so much bigger because people are watching and the world is watching, and that just makes it so exciting. But yeah, definitely a lot of, you know, making sure I'm staying focused while I was waiting around to compete. You know, it was the last event to go. So that was, you know, a lot of watching the Olympics and, you know, feeling excitement, but I have to, you know, stay locked in and stay focused on what I have to do. But honestly, like, I just had a blast. Like, it was so much fun. And especially compared to my first Olympic experience in Beijing, you know, with COVID and everything, my parents and family weren't able to come. So just honestly, this was just an amazing experience with my family and the support. And, you know, being in Italy, the food was amazing. So I was eating so much pizza and it was just so much fun. And to cap it off with a medal, my first Olympic medal, it just means so much. And it's a really big dream come true.
We often wonder how people get into winter sports being from Great Britain, but A, your accent, and B, where you live sort of gives away the fact that it's slightly more trodden path for you.
Yeah, I was born in America and I grew up there, but my dad is British, my mom is Malaysian, so I've had all these kind of like influences growing up. And
we're very pleased you went with your dad.
Yeah, very sensible. Yeah, no, it's really special to represent the community. And all my, you know, extended family came from England and they were so stoked to wave the flag. So it was just really special to do it for them and my dad and my family. But yeah, it's definitely, it's a very niche sport what I do, half pipe. But I mean, anyone can really, you know, go skiing. And I feel like it's, you know, fun to kind of jump off things and get any airtime you can.
You say that. So, I mean, I want to know, how do you know that you could be good at the half pipe? I mean, I watch it and I just think it's every moment I watch, it feels like a multitude of accidents waiting to happen. So what is it like when you first start? You must just fall over, break things all the time.
Oh gosh. I mean, when we start at the very beginning, obviously it's a huge, huge half pipe, 22 foot walls of ice. But you know, when you're young, I think I first went into the half pipe when I was 9 years old, just because it was at my local mountain in Utah and I just, you know, wandered in there. But I didn't, you know, go 5 meters out at, you know, when I was 9 years old.
So
I just
kind of
skied. You can just ski right in the bottom and ski all the way down and slowly work your way up the walls. And obviously, you know, as you, you know, push your limits and push yourself a little bit every day, you can get higher and higher and higher. And then yeah, maybe one day you're going 5 meters at the Olympics.
I mean, you jumped higher than anyone else by some distance in that final. How do you get that sort of spring?
Yeah, obviously we, you know, train a lot in the gym. So there's like kind of the strength portion of things. But I think, you know, the real part of going that high out of the half pipe is it's really scary. And that's kind of why you don't see many people going that high out, because, you know, it makes this margin of error so much smaller and it just makes it so much more dangerous because you're falling from so much higher. And for me, that's honestly just been, yeah, pushing myself a little bit more every single day. And I work with a sports psychologist, and also part of, you know, what I'm studying at university has to do with psychology. So I'm kind of learning about the brain and thought processes and overcoming fear. And I think that's really been key to my progression, is, you know, being okay in that really fearful state and having that anxiety and being like, I'm scared, but, you know, I can do it anyway. You know, I train for this. Obviously, I wouldn't recommend an average person to go and do that.
Jane, don't
I trained to don't do this.
It.
I'm ruling so it out be careful.
Imminently.
Can I ask what you want to do with the rest of your life? What would your chosen profession be?
Oh, gosh. I do not know. I mean, I'm really happy with doing this for now, so we'll have to see. I would love to go maybe to another Olympic Games in 4 years, but obviously that's a really long time away. So I think for now I'm just going to enjoy this Olympic medal in this moment. And then I think, yeah, keep going with the skiing, keep pushing myself a little bit. And then, yes, maybe I'll use my university degree at some point. But
can the rest of us learn from your kind of your psychological tricks that or tricks or coping mechanisms that you have at the top? I mean, I was looking at you ahead of that final run and I was thinking, gosh, you know, I'd be almost anyone else in the world. You were last to go. You've got to put down this amazing trick. And somehow you look calm. You did it amazingly well. Everyone says you should have got silver, if not gold. So, you know, you must have been really pleased with that. But, you know, I get terribly nervous just outside before I come in and talk to Jane and Fee every afternoon. What coping strategies can I take from your half pipe?
Well, thank you. I feel like anxiety is such a normal part of the human experience. And obviously, maybe I feel it more acutely because what I'm doing is, you know, very like physically dangerous. So there's, you know, that kind of element of things. But I mean, everyone has anxiety from whether you're, you know, maybe you're socially anxious to talk to somebody new or you're raising your hand in class at university or, you know, whatever it may be. And I feel like those are the moments where you kind of show yourself what is important to you and like what you really care about. And that anxiety kind of just means that you care. And it doesn't need to be framed in a bad way that you know, can't do it because you're anxious. And I feel like for me, I kind of feel that anxiety and just allow myself to feel it and know that it's because I care and that it's a positive way. And it's a way for me to push my own limits and expand my comfort zone. And I feel like that's where you really feel the growth of yourself as a person is in those moments where you're feeling that anxiety. So I feel like leaning into that anxiety is definitely something that I've tried to kind of embrace in my sport. And I guess would be my advice to anyone who's like feeling that in day-to-day life.
Do you understand what drove Lindsey Vonn to have another go?
I mean, she's kind of crazy. Like, it's so inspirational seeing her. Like, honestly, I mean, I understand where she's coming from. I don't know if I would have done the same thing. I mean, she's had such an amazing career that seems crazy to, you know, go back and do it again. But I mean, it's such an athlete mindset to, you know, wonder, like, what if you just tried a little bit harder or pushed a little bit more or, you know, didn't give up or whatever. And I feel like that's just such a testament to, you know, athleticism and her ability to like want to push herself to her full potential, regardless of winning or not. And I mean, obviously it was really awful to watch her crash, but I mean, it was really amazing to see her, you know, feel like, as she said in kind of her Instagram post, like to dare greatly and to really push herself to see what she could do. And I think that's really admirable.
Yeah. She is now out of hospital. Yes. She nearly lost the leg, but thankfully did not. And she is on her way home and she will do okay. So, that, you know, that's great. Talking of people we were slightly worried about, your fellow freestyle skier, Kirsty Muir, who came fourth twice. How is she doing?
I know, that's pretty brutal. I mean, Kirsty is such an amazing skier and she was definitely one of our medal hopefuls on Team GB. And I definitely know that she is probably quite disappointed. I mean, I saw her at closing ceremonies and she seemed to be in pretty good spirits, but I know there, I kind of have had a similar experience last Olympic Games, you know, feeling quite disappointed with my performance. But I think that, I mean, for her, she's so young. She has such a bright future. And at the end of the day, like, obviously the Olympics, you know, mean so much and there's so much like press and hoopla around them. But at the end of the day, it's just one competition and it's like 30 seconds, you know, your run is that's like 30 seconds of your life. And there's going to be more competitions and more Olympics in the future. And, you know, I think she's going to dust herself off and get right back into it. And she's like one of the best. So I think we're going to see her again.
Yeah. And Jane asked the question that there's help there for her to sort of to cope with the disappointment, right?
Definitely. Yeah, of course. I mean, all of the teammates and all of Team GB has just been so amazing. I mean, I definitely felt that support in Beijing when I was really disappointed with the way that I skied. And I think, yeah, it's really good to, you know, have other things outside of your sport as well so that, you know, you feel developed as like a person and you have other things going on, just, you know, and your life, it doesn't surround, you know, your skiing results. Of course, they matter so much and we work so hard to, you know, get there. But at the end of the day, like, although this is an amazing achievement, I'm super proud of it. It is just like a medal. And I feel like there's so much more to life than just sport.
Yeah. Well, there is, but don't underestimate the pleasure it gives
on the pink medal.
You know, it's great.
Of course, of course.
I mean, you know, give yourself a pat on the back. You're very flexible. You should be able to do that. It was really lovely to meet you, and congratulations again.
Thank you so much.
And I just hope you continue to meet success in whatever field you choose. Thank you.
Thank you.
Olympic bronze medalist Zoe Atkin and Vassos will be with us tomorrow as well.
Well, look forward to it. Very nice to meet you. Coming up, do you believe in witches? Crime writer and traitors contestant Harriet Tice will be here to discuss her new book, Witch Trial. We will get a check on the latest news headlines first. It's just gone 3:30. Here's Laura Cook.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Prime Minister has accused Vladimir Putin of blocking a peace deal in Ukraine as the Kremlin said it still hadn't achieved its ambitions in now the four-year-long conflict. Former Ukrainian ambassador to the UK, Vadim Pryshtyko, has been speaking to Times Radio. He also believes Vladimir Putin's goals means the war is unlikely to end anytime soon.
The biggest problem is that not many of us believe that he's actually looking for the peace in any composition. So we might want to give or to discuss or compromise. The problem is that he is not giving up his hopes to control the whole Ukraine. And that's something Ukrainians are not going to give him.
Sir Keir Starmer has also confirmed fresh sanctions on Moscow's banking and energy industries. A warrant to arrest Valdo Kallikane before he killed three people in Nottingham wasn't executed by police for months before the attacks. An inquiry has heard it described as a serious systemic operational failure. Kallikane killed University of Nottingham students Barnaby Webber and Grace O'Malley Kumar and caretaker Ian Coates in June 2023. The warrant was issued in September 2022, 10 months before the killings. Ministers have confirmed they support a motion to release documents about Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor's appointment as trade envoy. It's been brought by the Liberal Democrats, who are leading the push in Parliament for the release of the files. Russell Brand has pleaded not guilty to two further sexual offences, including an alleged rape in 2009. The former comedian's previously denied all other charges against him. And a Labour MP is writing to the BBC for more information about how a racial slur was broadcast during the BAFTA Awards. Tourette's campaigner John Davidson could be heard shouting as Cine stars Michael B. Jordan and Delroy Lindo presented an award. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Okay, that's six of the ragu and the linguine. Make a move, everyone, please.
The customers are rolling in at Stefano's new restaurant, so he needs another chef. Someone with a cool head and an appetite for success.
More flour in the bechamel, let's go.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Jane Garvey and Feig Lover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. Choose from over 80 kitchen styles. Whether it's your first home or your forever home, find your dream kitchen at Wix. Prices start from under £3,000. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Harriet Tice has sold millions of books. You might have read Blood Orange or A Lesson in Cruelty. They're informed by her time as a barrister. And her latest book, Witch Trial, really taps into her knowledge of the courtroom. We meet two young girls who are on trial for murder, murder by witchcraft, really. And the book unfolds around the members of the jury in the trial too, notably Matthew, a surgeon whose outwards appearance, suited and booted, belies a muddled mind sinking into something less than ideal for the justice system. You might also know Harriet as the woman from Traitors who saw through Rachel, and more on that in a moment. We were just talking about the nature of fame, Harriet. Would you mind sharing with us the Gaviscon anecdote? Because I think it sums up something about this
very much
country.
Our audience, Gaviscon.
Yes, I had a nice lunch and I had picked up some Gaviscon just to settle it down, and I was standing beside the bin opposite Borough Market to get rid of the cellophane, and I was carefully chewing one while getting the other out of the little container, and a lady tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Harriet, we love you." And I said, oh, I'm just having some Gaviscon now. And she said, oh, no, well, you should work in HR. You were brilliant. Can we have a photo? And so I, you know, tried to stop chewing and get the chalk off my teeth and smile. So it's odd. And it's, yeah, yesterday walking the dog, you know, you've got a bag of dog poo being called an icon. It's not normal.
Oh, do you know how it doesn't get any better than that.
You haven't peaked at all. I think what's extraordinary, and we won't talk too much about traitors because it's not your job, is it? I mean,
no.
Your job is now as a writer and a really successful writer. But I wonder about your understanding of what would happen to you when you went on Traitors.
I don't think that there was any way of predicting it. There's no way really of knowing either what the experience itself will be like of being inside the game and being caught inside what is essentially a large-scale psychological experiment and you know, and how one will react to that on an emotional basis. But I'd say that the, you know, afterwards, that is also unpredictable, because what I didn't know in advance was how I would land with the public, whether people would like me, whether people would dislike me, what people would think of what I'd done. And I mean, of course, you know, I lost my temper at breakfast, that, you know, hideous phrase about cats and pigeons that's going to haunt me forever. You know, that led to a level of pushback, but I certainly didn't know that actually my actions would resonate with quite so many people, both young and old. I mean, it's a surprising level, you know, that I'm speaking to you now, but I'm also going to be talking to someone who normally interviews Love Island participants, who are, you know, people in their 20s, who are the age of my children. And it seems to have cut across generations in a way that I simply couldn't have predicted. And while I knew the show was big, I also think I had an aspect of denial about what the recognisability would be like and how it would feel having people knowing my face. But, you know, at the same time, I know perfectly well that this is going to fade. You know, it's already started to fade, and that as the months go on and as other TV shows come on, I'd say that it's likely that I will be, if not forgotten, at least people will just be like, hang on, do I know her, rather than you're Harriet. So
yeah,
it'll be okay.
And you'll be able to take the indigestion tablets and peace out.
Everyone is lovely. I will say that everybody has been very friendly. It's always very nice.
There are similarities, having read your latest book, Witch Trial, with the setting, really, of Traitors.
Yes.
And the book, because we are in court, aren't we, at a trial by jury, a place that you know very well as a former barrister. The mm-hmm. similarity with the Traitors house is just working out people's allegiances, what you're going to say that might convert somebody, watching all of those human reactions between each other. I mean, it is a big central part of a Venn diagram going on.
I think I've always been interested in the idea of a jury, and I've written four novels before that which have explored different aspects of criminal justice. The first three from the perspective of a barrister, the fourth looking more at prison and the idea of punishment and redemption. And so I think it was inevitable that at some point I would come to investigating a jury. I am very interested in what goes into the decision-making process and how would you have that cross-section of society arbitrarily chosen. It can lead to, you know, I think is a cornerstone of justice in our system and should be held onto. But I mean, that's a slightly separate point. But I have always felt that those differing narrative perspectives are something that would be worth examination. And so that was why I chose to write about it in the book. I think it's also why I enjoy watching the show. The coincidences between the book and the show were not intended, but clearly the themes are something that interests me, you know, both as a viewer and as a former lawyer. So I guess it kind of tied together that it's been part of an ongoing obsession of mine.
Are you also very interested in the forces of evil? Because obviously witchcraft lies at the heart of this. And as you explain, and we'll be very careful not to give away endings and ruin the book for people, but you explain right at the beginning, this is a murder trial of two very, very young girls who are
almost believed to have frightened one of their schoolmates to death using the forces of witchery.
Yes, and I never have done an Ouija board because I've always thought, what if it goes wrong? And I have steered very clear of tarot cards until recently. I only looked into them when I needed to research them for the book. I am generally a very rational person, but at the same time, I don't think there's any sense in messing with things that could go wrong. And having listened to a lot of Uncanny, the Danny Robson podcast, where it's you want to believe, I think is his line, that there is this sort of idea that it's quite nice to think it could be true, but you don't want it to be true as well. So as a teenager, I steered really well clear of it. Friends of mine dabbled all the time and loved it, but I didn't think it was worth it. And if I read books about witches and the supernatural, I would end up so frightened that I couldn't sleep. And so I can't watch horror. I don't read books about it. And researching this book was, I frightened myself more than I should have done. But on the other hand, I hope that some of that fear might come through to frighten the reader as well. And I think that, you know, there are various explanations provided throughout the book as to what's happening. And what I like, I think, for me as an author is the fact that I play with the ambiguity, is what's true, what isn't true, what could have happened, what might not have happened. And, you know, that's for the reader to decide, really, because I'm not sure even I know.
There is a theme of girls being mean to girls.
Yes.
And you are a mum yourself. There is, yes, the death of a child at the heart of this. I always think that must be actually just incredibly difficult to write. And we have interviewed writers who say that's the one place actually I can't go to.
I didn't go there for very long, and I didn't spend too much. I mean, that there are a couple of chapters from the perspective of the bereaved mother, and I tried not to spend too long in that place because I think it is too hard. It really is too hard. I mean, I'll make a confession here, which is that I have not read Hamlet, nor am I going to see it. Not because I don't hear extraordinary things about it, not because I don't think it sounds like an amazing book, but I just don't want to go there into that space and to read about that grief, because I can, well, I don't want to imagine it. That's just it. And I think without suffering that loss, it's impossible. And I never want to suffer that loss. Mm. I think in terms of the meanness overall, I mean, you know, I was a teenage girl and I was in an all-girls school for quite a while. And I think that there is nothing worse. I mean, if you put girls in Lord of the Flies, it would have been much more of a bloodbath, I think. But it would have been death by a thousand cuts rather than just punches. It's... That was hard enough, actually, to imagine in the book, was the ostracising. And I employ the use of the silent treatment as a weapon. And that felt bad enough, actually. Imagining that was almost harder than imagining the curses and the supernatural aspects, because that thing where people just cut you off and will not speak to you is yeah, to my mind, one of the worst things that there is.
And it is all there, isn't it, in the teenagers' lives now, yeah, in various forms,
yes,
not just in I'm not going to go behind the bike sheds and smoke a cigarette with you. It is there on their phones. It lives
constant,
with them.
Constant,
yeah,
constant,
which you
constant
recognise.
No, it's horrible.
In the book.
It's horrible.
Why did you stop being a barrister?
I had a baby. Basically, I mean, it was back in, thank you. I mean, this was back in 2004. I mean, I'd been at the bar. Never has a very short and non-illustrious career at the bar led to more discussion and books. It's extraordinary how I've repurposed it. But I was nearly 10 years cool, and I had a baby at the beginning of 2004. And I tried going back part time because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to work 3 days a week, and it was impossible to develop any kind of practice and only to work 3 days a week. And I was the primary carer for our children. And the criminal bar legal aid does not earn very much money. You know, it didn't then, and I think it's almost less now. So I would have had to pay childcare that was more than I would have been earning. And that seemed a bit silly, really, as a way of doing things.
So it's another profession that has a fatal flaw in the system then, isn't it?
Yes, it's completely impossible. It's completely impossible to do it on a part-time basis. The amount of flexibility that's required, because a big trial comes in, you know, a couple of days before, and suddenly you have to go to Nottingham and stay in a travel lodge for 3 weeks while you do a, you know, a big gun trial. It's great if you can drop everything, but if you can't drop everything, then there is no way forward. And I think that's why there's such a huge drop off at the bar between, you know, recruitment at the junior level, which is almost at 50-50 or almost tip more in favour of women. But by the time you come to looking at the numbers for Silk and the judiciary, there has been a huge, huge rate of attrition. And I think it's because it is so hard to do it and actually deal with being the primary carer.
And do you know whether a reform of that part of the system is being included in the government's very comprehensive attempt to revive the whole criminal justice system?
Do you know what? I don't know. And that's something I would be interested to look into. I have to say, the reform I read about this morning, which was to stop there being a cap on the number of days that Crown Courts could sit, and that's going to be expanded now, which is a good thing, and the criminal bar seems to be welcoming that. But, you know, the more days that there are trials in court, the more time that barristers will be expected to work, and thus the more childcare that will be required, and the circle goes on. It's an all-consuming job if you do it properly.
Mm. Yeah, but then you've got, it's not just women, but mostly women waiting for their rape cases to come to court. So
this is it.
Huge problem, isn't it?
This is it. And I think in a way it's more important that justice is done, but I'm not quite sure what the solution is, really.
You do seem quite passionate about juries, though. And I don't know whether we haven't had news of another government U-turn on the David Lammy idea of trying to have fewer trials with juries, but it's possibly something the government won't be doing now. But he did float the notion, and he floated the notion because he needs, you know, cases need to be heard.
And I can see the logic again. Yeah. It is going to cut the backlog. It will be cheaper. And there is something to be said about making everything move faster. But the difficulty is that judges will also have their own bias. If you have 12 members of a jury, or, you know, 15 as it is in Scotland, 12 members of a jury, that means you would hope across the board that people are going to weigh out each other's prejudices. And everyone I know who has done jury duty has taken that responsibility incredibly seriously. So it's still better. I know that if I got nicked for shoplifting, and that would be for me a catastrophic allegation, you know, I'm of good character, I would not want to go into a magistrate's court and to be just done as part of a cog turning. I would want to be tried by a jury of my peers in the hope that that would mean that my good character was maintained. And I think anyone in my position would want that. It's still better than having, you know, one judge who might bring his or her own prejudices to the table and not have anyone to counter that. It's a cornerstone of our system. Mm. But yet that it's intractable, because on the one hand, the system needs to move faster and more cheaply. But on the other, justice has to be done properly, and people have to find a solution. I don't envy anyone who has to make decisions on how to make it work better. No. I'll tell you that. Mm.
So you were very fortunate then that you could write, because you really can write, and your books are very successful. They are absolutely loved by readers. Did you know inside yourself that you had that talent when you decided to strike out?
No. I mean, I left because I had been... I mean, the reason that the day of the decision of leaving the bar was I was in Uxbridge Magistrates Court representing someone who'd bought a car for £2,000 in cash in a pub, and he'd tried to say he hadn't known it was stolen. And I said, well, do you want me to tell the court you're stupid? And he said, no. And I said, well, in that case, you might need to think about this. And we had to wait for a pre-sentence report to be prepared on the day by a probation officer sitting in court, which meant that it ran about 4 hours longer than it was meant, which meant that I was several hours late to get back and pick the baby up from the childminder. Fortunately, she didn't mind, but, you know, nurseries wouldn't operate like that. And I thought, I can't do this. Mm. And so for 3 or 4 years, I was, you know, a stay-at-home mum with a with a bit of an unresolved anger management issue, because I was so frustrated creatively and professionally. And I mean, yes, I should have gone and looked for a job at the CPS or with a solicitor's firm, but also I felt it was important to be at home, and I was just torn. And I started an evening course in writing just as a way of finding a hobby, doing something else. And it was through that that I discovered that I could. I didn't know that I could. And it was a punt that started out just as a way of getting out of the house.
What a punt it's turned out to be. You specialise in a real twist of an ending, and we absolutely mustn't talk too much about the ending.
I love the ending of this book. I love the ending of this book.
Yeah, I've never come across anything like it, because of the parts that are played with everybody involved in the scene, and I'll leave it at that, Harriet. But did you, and do you know the ending when you start out at the beginning?
No, not generally. I mean, I might have a vague idea of what, say the ending of Blood Orange, I knew something was going to happen, but I didn't know to whom, and it was only two-thirds of the way in that I decided who the victim of that particular circumstance would be. My second book, I thought I knew the ending, and then the last twist presented itself almost as I wrote the end. I was suddenly like, oh, that there. This one I had thought was a more, shall we say, traditional narrative, and that was the plan. And then other layers just kept presenting themselves, and then unfortunately I started to have fun. And I really was entertaining myself quite. That I think my favourite line, well, I have two favourite lines in the book. One is that Fleabag was the worst thing to happen to ministers. And the second is that you do not, in fact, look like Yves Morisson in On the Waterfront. And I really, that was a lot of fun to write.
Is that a reference to Lloyd Cole and the Commotions?
Yes, Rattlesnakes.
Yeah, great song.
Isn't it? It's wonderful.
It's one of the songs.
Yeah, it is.
I think I listened to that on repeat coming back from a school skiing trip at the age of 13. It was the only thing that still worked on my Walkman, because the rest of the tape had got a little bit...
Oh, they were great. They were such a good band.
Yeah, they are.
Happy
Absolutely.
Days, happy memories. Are you going to do Bake Off? There's a rumour that you are.
Well, I just made it up.
I mean, I like baking. I have applied in the past to Bake Off because I always thought it looked rather fun. But actually, I think after my recent foray into reality TV, I'm not sure I can handle the pressure. Right. And
also, Harriet, do you think that there's a kind of Bilderberg group of TV producers that meet once a year and say, well, have this person on all of them? We won't have them on any of them. Would you be allowed to?
I mean, I think that they're most likely would be restrictions from the BBC as to what one could participate in. But also I feel that there is something about knowing when it's time to leave the party. I think that's a phrase I've used before. I think that my experience on Traitors went surprisingly well, and that any stuff that I regret, I have managed, you know, we've dealt with it, because, you know, honestly, I defy anyone not to lose their temper under that level of pressure. But I also think that, you know, what I do is I write books. I sit at home in my pyjamas making things up and, you know, scarf Gaviscon beside the bins. And I think that it's been lovely to come back into the world of books. And this is what I enjoy, and this is what I know. So I think Bake Off, I might make the odd cake for my kids, but now they're grown up, you know, there's much less demand for baking. You know, exactly.
Yeah. Harriet, it's a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you very much for coming into Times Towers today. This has come in actually from Francesca, who says it's really good to hear Harriet chatting about this subject. You can't work part-time at the criminal bar. I'm a criminal barrister and went on eternity leave between 2015 to 2021 to have my children. The only plus side is we are self-employed, so I can take the school holidays off.
Yes. Yes, well, good luck. And I admire very much anyone who manages to make it work. And I think it will be at a great cost to self. I didn't have the wherewithal mentally to do it. And while it's something I've regretted, at the same time, I know my limitations. So, you know, hats off, well, wigs off to anyone who does make that work. Really, I admire you greatly.
Yeah, but we definitely do need women to be in court at all levels, don't we?
No,
because
often
women are the victims in court.
Yeah.
You need to feel that you are amongst at least some of your peers.
Yeah, that's right. And just as the jury is important to have a balance, I feel that the entire courtroom should be a reflection of the society in which we live.
Lovely to meet you, Harriet. Thank you very much indeed. Witch Trial is out in hardback now.
It's Jane O'Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Listen to Times Radio every night from 10 for a first take on the stories making the headlines. Plus, explore the wider news agenda with thought-provoking guests from across politics, business, the arts and more. It's your dream nightly destination for the finest mix of news, culture and conversation. Late nights on Times Radio with Times Holidays. Explore, plan and now book the perfect holiday inspired by the journalists you trust. Search Times Holidays.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. That's why it's no surprise that more than 85% of the Fortune 500 use the ServiceNow AI platform. While other platforms duct tape tools together, ServiceNow seamlessly unifies people, data, workflows, and AI, connecting every corner of your business. And with AI agents working together autonomously, anyone in any department can focus on the work that matters most. Learn how ServiceNow puts AI to work for people at servicenow.co.uk.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Our guest today was the novelist and star of The Traitors, Harriet Tice. And the book, highly recommended by Fiona, is...
Fiona. Why did you suddenly call me Fiona Jane Susan?
But why not? The book is called...
It's called Witch Trial.
Okay.
Two girls accused of murder, a defence like no other.
Yeah, well, Harriet seemed... I mean, she seemed a very good egg. But, I mean, it's so difficult, isn't it, on television? Because she's right, she will be forever associated with really... I mean, am I right in saying just that one incident at the breakfast table in Traitors?
When she put the cat among the pigeons.
Yeah.
Yes, and she really called out Rachel. And it was odd watching it, because obviously we all knew that Rachel had been a traitor from the get-go.
Yeah, so she was entirely
right. She just seemed to be immune. Mm-hmm. And Harriet was the person who really properly got the closest to the truth of it all.
Yeah.
So, you know, we were all behind Harriet. Mm.
Yes, okay. But sometimes there's something about somebody losing it that gets everybody else's goat, even if the person who's losing it is doing so entirely legitimately.
Yes, I would agree with that. Yeah.
Thank you. That's a rare, wonderful moment. Now, Fiona is not here tomorrow. But I am. And Fiona's back on Thursday.
I am. When I'm just going to ask to be referred to by my normal name, my stage name, Fee. Otherwise, I just feel like I've done something terribly wrong, Jen.
Yeah, no, I know, and I don't want to tell you off. The guest tomorrow afternoon is one of my favourite writers, actually, Ellie Griffiths, who's just created so many female central characters in her books that I can properly relate to. And her latest is the time-travelling detective, Ali Dawson. I have travelled through time many a time in my radio experiences. So Ellie Griffiths with us tomorrow, talking about her novel, The Killing Time, and also talking too about a man called Mesmer. And Mesmer's really interesting. He's someone who, after whom we have invented the word mesmerise. Did you know that?
Well, I didn't know that at all.
I did not know that either till I started reading this book.
And who was Mesmer?
Well, he was a slightly creepy individual connected to hypnosis, mesmerising, and all kinds of jiggery-pokery. So that will be fully investigated tomorrow afternoon, I can tell you that.
Well, sounds good, I might listen.
Our producer today was Hannah Quinn. Our technical operator was Ryan Boyden. And John Pienaar joins you next with Drive. Don't forget, if you want to hear the State of the Union with President Trump, you can do so 2 a.m. here on Times Radio with the excellent Tom Noonan. That is tomorrow morning. Mark your card, set your alarm. John's next. Have a good evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jane. Thank you for your 4 o'clock. I'm John Pienaar. And this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. John Healey has told Times Radio he wants to be the defence secretary that puts UK boots on the ground in Ukraine. And the Trade Minister, Chris Bryant, has described Andrew Mountbatten Windsor as rude, arrogant and entitled while speaking in the House of Commons. And coming up, my full conversation with the defence secretary, John Healey. And I'll be getting the view from the Ukrainian front lines, talking to soldiers who've been fighting since the start of the invasion.
This is Times Radio.
And now the news with Laura Cook.
Thank you. Good afternoon. John Healey has told Times Radio he wants to be the defence secretary to put UK boots on the ground in Ukraine. He says he wants to see the Russian war end this year, but accused President Putin of dragging his feet in peace talks. The defence secretary says if Moscow takes negotiations seriously, Britain is ready to secure peace for the long term.
Every conflict, every war has to end in negotiation. I want to see 2026, the year that this war does end. I want to be the defence secretary that deploys UK troops into Ukraine, because that will mean we've got a negotiated peace in place.
You can hear the full interview with John on Times Radio Drive following this bulletin. Trade Minister Chris Bryant has told the Commons the release of documents relating to Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's appointment as trade envoy may take some time. As he told MPs, the government will comply with the motion in full. He issued a caveat drawing attention to the live police investigation. But he was adamant that the Lib Dem motion to release the documents has their full support.
Let me be clear from the outset, we support this motion today. Frankly, it is the least we owe the victims of the horrific abuse that was perpetrated by Jeffrey Epstein and others. The abuse that was enabled, aided and abetted by a very extensive group of arrogant, entitled and often very wealthy individuals in this country and elsewhere.
Andrew has always denied any wrongdoing. The inquiry into the Nottingham stabbings of two students and a caretaker should be a turning point for society, according to the mother of a victim. It was revealed yesterday that Valdo Calacane wasn't sectioned after a previous attack because of a concern that too many black men were in custody. The inquiry has also heard how an arrest warrant wasn't executed by police for months before the attacks, in what's being described as a serious systemic operational failure. Emma Webber lost her son Barnaby and says even the community health team were aware that he was a risk.
Nobody wanted anything to do with him. They were so scared of him. They were terrified to deal with him. They were even given notice that they were not allowed to visit him on their own because he was so dangerous.
US TV host Savannah Guthrie and her family are now offering $1 million for the return of their missing mother.
Every hour and minute and second and every long night has been agony. We need her to come home. Someone out there knows something. Somebody knows. We are begging you.
It's been 24 days since Nancy Guthrie is believed to have been taken from her home in Arizona. The 84-year-old has difficulty walking, a pacemaker, and takes medicine every day for a heart condition. Her relatives have made several public pleas for proof that she's alive. And streaming platforms including Netflix and Prime Video will be regulated like traditional broadcasters. They'll have to follow rules around providing impartial news content. And don't forget, you can set the Times Radio news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with ServiceNow. Well, it was expected to last around 4 days, maybe less. Today, 4 years to the day after Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine. I'm talking to soldiers fighting on the front line of combat, to Ukrainian women who'll open up about the lives of ordinary people in extraordinary conditions. And you'll also hear from this 4-year-old girl.
My name is Sophia. I live with my dad, mum and little sister. At nursery, I play with mosaics. I play with beads and threads and I play in the leaves. And I play with eggs and a little pig and ducks. And I don't hear the air raid sirens. And during the war, my life goes on calmly. But when there is a siren, we go to the big hall and then we eat something there. When the shareheads come, I hide under my blanket.
Yeah. We're also going to be hearing from the Ukrainian bishop in his London cathedral, who's now helping his displaced congregation get through the day on a mixture of faith, tea and company when they need it most. And in a moment, you can hear my conversation at that church with John Healy, who told me he wants to be the defence secretary who orders British troops into Ukraine to help oversee the peace when it comes and to help guard Ukraine's freedom from future Russian aggression. The talk of Ukraine's subjugation, that was 4 years ago. It seems so much longer, doesn't it? I'm John Pienaar, and this is Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. And tell me, what are you thinking on this, the fourth anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Send me a text, 87222, start with the word Times, or tweet to @TimesRadio. First then, as I say, I met the Defence Secretary, John Healy, at the Ukrainian Catholic Cathedral in London. That was ahead of the programme, and I started by asking if he agreed it was now obvious that Vladimir Putin had no interest in peace and would have to be made by military force and economic pressure to agree terms for a ceasefire that were fair and were just to Ukraine.
They will. Putin will. But he will not win this war. This was a war that he thought he'd win within a week. Instead, 4 years to the day, the Ukrainians, military and civilians alike, are still fighting with the same courage and defiance. And Putin is failing. He likes to present himself as a strong man, but the truth is he's lost over 1 million men. He's been fighting now in Ukraine for longer than the Soviet Union fought Germany during the Second World War. And he is making very slow progress.
The war is pretty much a stalemate. It is deadlocked. But you do recognise, I'm sure you do, that on all the evidence that we can see, President Putin does not want a ceasefire. The talks are, to that extent, to put it very, very bluntly, something of a charade. And that is now recognised across Europe among Ukraine's friends, as well as in Kyiv.
I don't accept that, and nor would the Ukrainians, and nor would the US. I mean, we're backing President Trump because President Trump is doing what only President Trump can do, which is to bring the parties together. There are further peace talks later this week. But your first question is right. This is a combination of keeping Ukraine strong, capable of withstanding this full-scale invasion, which means stepping up our military aid, including our training of Ukrainian troops, as well as our weaponry and air defence systems, which we've recently stepped up. It requires us also, alongside the US, to put more pressure on Putin to come to the table. That involves fresh economic sanctions and potentially action that we can take and will take on things like shadow shipping, which is his way of avoiding sanctions and fueling this war in Ukraine.
And those things are vitally important. But Secretary of State, are you saying that you do not consider that President Putin is stalling in these talks, setting one set of impossible demands after another? Or is it that you have to say that? It's not something you can openly acknowledge, although you know it perfectly well.
He's clearly dragging his